funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If you've ever taken a transcontinental flight, you know how exhausting it is to travel several thousand miles at a stretch. Now imagine taking that same trip on your own power, without a single stop for food or rest, in a body that weighed less than a teacup. That's the story of the little shorebird called the Red Knot. You can sometimes spot these migratory miracles on the Texas Gulf Coast, and their most traveled relatives make an annual round trip from the southernmost tip of South America all the way to the Arctic and back in a series of legs perfectly timed to give the birds ample access to food in the places they do stop to refuel, including a landing in Delaware Bay at exactly the moment millions of horseshoe crabs have scrambled up onto land to spawn. It all timed out beautifully for a very long time, but the past few decades of development, beach erosion, climate change, and over-harvesting of the crabs has meant more birds leave hungry for their next long flight segment, and fewer survive to return with each succeeding year. Author Deborah Kramer explores what has changed and what this one story suggests for a number of species threatened by human activity in her new book, The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and an Epic Journey. Deborah, welcome to Think.
It's a pleasure to be here.
How have North American shorebird populations changed just in the course of our lifetimes?
Well, it was stunning to me when I finally had a chance to sit down and actually do the calculations that since 1974, when I was graduated from college, for just 19 species of birds that scientists were able to keep track of year after year, we had lost about half, or 12 million shorebirds.
How did you get interested in red knots specifically, and what makes them an ideal species through which to understand how interconnected the ecosystem is?
Well, they're a great species to study because they fly all the way from the tip of South America up into the Arctic. And at every stopover, they carry an imprint of what their life is like there. So at the end of this really long journey, they give us a measure of the health of the coast.
They're not spectacular to look at as shorebirds go. They're pretty tiny little sandpiper relatives, but that only makes their migration habits more fascinating.
I think so. It was, I have to confess, very difficult for me at the beginning to actually identify these birds in a cluster of sandpipers. I think everybody has seen sandpipers flocking along the beach, and the red knot is a sandpiper, but it's much more rare than a lot of sandpipers. So at the beginning, particularly in the winter when it's looking a little gray, it's hard to distinguish. But in the spring and summer, it has this beautiful russet-colored plumage, which makes it a little easier to see. And if you go to Delaware Bay, where there are several thousand of them on beaches that you can get really, where you have a lot of ability to look onto the beach, they're very easy to see.
We have a little sound here, not in Delaware Bay, but in Fortescue, New Jersey, where they are feeding on horseshoe crab eggs, and there's a whole lot of them. Let's listen. Does that sound familiar to you, Deborah?
Well, it's quite an amazing scene. One evening, I went out on a beach in Delaware Bay to look at the crabs. And in order to see them spawning, they come in at spring's highest tides at the new and full moon in May and June. So this coming weekend is going to be a really big weekend for horseshoe crab spawning in Delaware Bay. And the last time I went, and I'm hoping to go again this weekend, I went out on a beach. I think the high tide was at midnight, and there was nobody else on the beach. And I stood there, and as the tide reached its highest mark, in either direction along the entire length of the beach, I could see thousands of horseshoe crabs. If I had been an hour earlier or an hour later, I would have missed the entire thing because they come in at the high tide and then they go back into the water. The next day, I went out onto the beach and there were thousands of shorebirds scurrying quickly across the sand, so many birds that I could hardly see the sand underneath, eating the eggs that had been washed up by the waves. People come from all over Europe and Australia and New Zealand to come and see this because this is one of the few places where you can actually get very close to the birds.
And they are tapped out when they arrive there in Delaware Bay and need to eat this protein-rich food left behind for them courteously by their horseshoe crab friends.
Well, it's an exhausting trip. They're flying 7,500 miles from Tierra del Fuego. And some of them stop in Argentina along the way, and some of them stop in Brazil. But that leg of that flight sometimes involves a 4,000 or 5,000 mile nonstop flight in 5 or 6 days. I think I'd be pretty tired if I had to do something like that. And I'd be pretty hungry. I mean, they double their weight in order to do this, and then they lose it all while they're flying and then have to double it again.
Yeah, one of the things that I found so fascinating, and I'll have you take us through, I guess, the typical a year in the life of a typical red knot, how their bodies change in the course of a year, because it's almost like everything about them is ready for whatever stage they're at, but it's perfectly calibrated for the specific time and place that they're going to be.
It's a physiological marvel. The longest period of time many of these birds are in one place would be in Tierra del Fuego, where they winter. That's on very unlike Delaware Bay. It's a extensive beach, extends for 64 or 70 miles, and the tidal flats are enormous. When I stand at the edge of the beach on Tierra del Fuego on a low tide, and I look out, I can't even see the ocean because the tide has receded 7 miles.
Wow.
So they arrive there sometime in October, and they spend the winter feeding and molting. They need a whole new set of feathers in order to make this long-distance journey. And then, I don't know, sometime in February, they head up to Argentina. It's a very different environment there, the birds that stop in Argentina. The water is quite warm, unlike Tierra del Fuego, where it's really cold and it's really windy and there are lots of storms. Argentina, this beach in Argentina at Las Grutas is warm and mild, and it's a big resort. So the birds are sharing the beach with lots of bathers, lots of ATVs, and it's a little harder for them to get the food they need. But they're able to do it, generally, and then they head up. Some of them stop in some tidal flats off the coast of Brazil, and then others head straight for Delaware Bay. Hmm. In Delaware Bay, they're again doubling their weight, and that's why I see them scurrying so quickly across the sand. They have to eat a lot of horseshoe crab eggs because these eggs are the size of a pinhead. So you have to eat many, many of them and gobble them down, probably 2 every second or so. So there have to be a lot of them there. And then once they're able to do that and the crabs have stopped spawning, you can kind of tell. I'm trying to think of a good way of describing this. You can be on the beach and there's a sense of restlessness on the beach. The birds are kind of flighty. They take off and then they land and then they take off again. And then you can tell there's been a change in the wind. The wind is now coming from the south. And then one night, they just take off, all of them. And they're heading for the Arctic where they're going to breed. And that is an entirely different environment. It's cold and inhospitable, And when they get there, there isn't any food, so they are still living off their fat. And if the spring is delayed, they're living off muscle. But they need to be ready to breed. So it's a real, these are birds that have demonstrated over the years an amazing amount of endurance and tenacity.
Do we know why they travel so far?
I think that the mysteries of bird migration have yet to fully unfold. One of the things that scientists understand is that the further north you move and the further south you move, the level of parasites and diseases and predators drops substantially. So if you're up in the Arctic where it's very cold, there aren't going to be as many predators as they'll be further south. So it's relatively safe for them there, but it's a high energy cost.
And of course, that could change as species, as the Arctic warms and maybe more predators find their way to the places that these birds need to be safe while they're breeding.
That's exactly correct. And of course, it's difficult to predict exactly what's going to happen. But one thing that is already noticeable is that the tundra is starting to move north as the tree line is moving north. So as the tundra moves north, the birds are going to probably move north also. Now, they're already nesting in the northernmost part of the world, so there's a limit to how far north they can go. They have survived in the past in situations like this, but the population may have dropped to about 400 birds, which is a pretty risky thing. The other thing that can happen in the Arctic is that, like in Delaware Bay, the arrival of the birds is timed to the arrival of horseshoe crabs. In the Arctic, those baby birds depend on this explosion of insects, which happens at the beginning of the Arctic summer. And if that explosion happens before they arrive, then they might not get enough food to eat. Now, that hasn't happened with the red knots yet, but it's happened a little further south with another gorgeous bird that I happen to be able to spend a lot of time with, the Hudsonian godwit. And they get up there, and the insects have already exploded and died, and those chicks are having a really hard time making it.
So is what happens that more chicks are, like, all the chicks are weaker because they don't get enough to eat, or just there's a select number of them that do get enough to eat and the rest of them die off immediately?
I don't know how well that's been studied. I know that the nesting success of the Hudsonian godwit in Churchill has been really bad. The birds end up walking 2 or 3 miles looking for food to eat. These tiny little chicks do this shortly after they're born. So the survival rate of the Hudsonian godwit up in Churchill isn't doing too well right now. For knots, I don't think we've experienced that particular situation yet.
My guest is author Deborah Kramer. She's a visiting scholar at MIT and has a new book out called The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and an Epic Journey. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Deborah Kramer about her new book, The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and an Epic Journey. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Okay, Deborah, we're going to take a quick break from talking about the migratory shorebirds called red knots, and I want to talk a little bit about horseshoe crabs, because these are equally remarkable animals, often referred to as living fossils, because I guess they haven't changed much in five major extinction periods.
Yes, the horseshoe crab is just as astonishing and wonderful an animal as the red knot. The red knot covers tremendous distances across space, but the horseshoe crab has endured through time. It has survived all of Earth's great mass extinctions, including the one that eliminated 97% of all life in the sea. And scientists keep finding older and older and older horseshoe crabs. So when I first wrote my first book about the ocean, Great Waters, I said that the horseshoe crab was 350 million years old. By the time I finished this one, scientists had found more fossils of horseshoe crabs, some in Canada and some in Morocco, in pieces of seafloor that are now part of the continents. And those fossils are 475 million years old. So much of the life that lived on the Earth at that time, including 15,000 species of tiny little animals called trilobites and large 6-foot-long shrimp-like torpedo animals, all of them are gone. But this animal, which looks so clunky when it comes ashore, but slides so gracefully through the water, is the one that's endured.
I was glad that you explained that in the book, that, you know, we see them, you know, kind of lumbering up onto the beach occasionally. And they're, I mean, you know, I suppose we're being speciesist here, but they're not the most beautiful creatures on the Earth. But in the water, it's a totally different thing.
Well, they're very graceful sliding through the water. But you're absolutely right, Chris. On land, you wonder how they can possibly survive. I was on a beach in Mispillion Harbor in Delaware, where we'd gone to count flagged birds, that is, red knots with tiny little flags on them, because that's the way, counting the flags every year is the way you keep track of the population. And the boat landed on the beach, and all the scientists were sitting in chairs with spotting scopes so they could read the tags. And I'm sitting in my chair, and these animals, whose shells are sometimes as large as dinner plates, are trying to climb up the legs of my chair. They're trying to climb up my wellies. And I keep thinking to myself, these guys seem really stupid. I mean, and yet they're obviously not. They have amazing capacity to survive.
You can't be stupid for 450 million years.
No, you certainly can't. And there's a lagoon in Germany, a really famous fossil site in Germany, where the fossils have been found of Archaeopteryx, the oldest bird. But what really interested me about that lagoon, which was a really salty lagoon, is that any animal that falls into that water dies pretty much as soon as it lands in the water. There's hardly any oxygen there. And that's why the bird fossils are so beautifully preserved. But in that lagoon is a track of a horseshoe crab. And that animal crawled extensively along the floor of the lagoon before it died. Hmm. And it's an incredible thing to watch this animal survive.
They have blue blood.
Yes, it's gorgeous. It's turquoise.
Why is it blue or turquoise?
Because there's copper in it. Ours has iron, and that's what makes it red. Theirs has copper, so when it comes in contact with oxygen, it's turquoise.
And they're not largely hunted to eat. I suppose you can eat them, but they are popular, or they're of use in the medical industry.
Yes, they're critical in the medical industry. If you or anybody listening to the show has ever had a vaccination for the flu or for whooping cough or measles, all of our vaccines, plus all of our IV-delivered antibiotics, plus all of the heart stents, hip replacements, knee replacements, plus all of the radioactive tracers that are in the PET scans that everybody's getting now, all of these drugs and medical devices are safe for us because the blood of the horseshoe crab is exquisitely sensitive to potentially lethal bacterial contamination in these drugs and devices.
So how does that work exactly?
Well, I actually had the ability to watch all of this. The fishermen who work for the biomedical companies collect the horseshoe crabs. Sometimes they do it from trawlers. Sometimes they do it along the seashore as the crabs are coming in to spawn. And then they take them to a place where they are bled. Usually, I think it takes, I was watching, about maybe 10 or 12 minutes. And the blood is collected in these bottles. And then the crabs are returned to the sea. And the special endotoxin detector that's in the blood is separated out from the plasma and turned into an assay that is used to test all of these drugs and devices. And I was privileged to, I wanted to see exactly how this was going to work. So I was privileged to go to Mass General Hospital, where a radioactive tracer that is used for PET scans and research to try to understand Alzheimer's disease and other kinds of dementia is made. And I stayed there while they made the tracer. These tracers don't last very long because they're radioactive and they have very short half-life. So you have to make it quickly, put it in the IV that's going to do someone's PET scan before it disintegrates. And so I watched them make it, and then we went into a quality control room where there are 30 pages of checkoffs to see whether there are solvents left in it and things like that. And then in one test, they put a little bit of it in this cartridge, and that registers the level of endotoxin there, and there wasn't any, so it went immediately to the patient who was waiting for his PET scan.
So we know that when these crabs are bled, the procedure is not that they'll be sort of killed and tossed aside. They're returned to the sea. Not enough blood has been taken to kill them. Do we know if it has any lifetime effect on their ability to breed or their ability to get around or whether they're more susceptible to predators? What do we know about the long-term effects of this blood donation program?
This is a controversial subject. Many people in the biomedical industry say that the number of horseshoe crabs that die in this process is pretty low. The regulators assume that about 15% of the crabs die, but there are studies that show it might be higher, 20, 25%, maybe even 28%. Secondly, it's not like we give blood and have juice and cookies afterwards and then go home. Up to, 25 or 30% of their blood can be taken. So when they go back into the water, there are a couple of studies that suggest they're a little dazed, wandering around, and may not be sensitive to the rhythms of the tides, and so may not come in to spawn. And it takes probably 6 months for their blood supply to be fully rejuvenated. This is a tremendous concern because the demand for horseshoe crab blood for these endotoxin tests is only increasing as the demand for vaccines and medical devices increases in South America, India, and China. And the supply of horseshoe crabs in Asia is very, very low now. However, I would just like, if it's okay, to put this in a bit of a broader context, which is that the horseshoe crabs are also being taken to use as bait. About 600,000 of them are taken every year along the eastern seaboard of the United States to use as bait. They're being used to catch eel, a species which by itself might belong on the endangered species list, and whelk, a fish that, whelk, it's a shellfish that whose numbers are might also be declining, and that's entirely an export fishery. There is an alternative bait. Instead of using half a horseshoe crab, you can use a 12th or 24th of a horseshoe crab. And if it were required for people to use that bait, then we could substantially reduce the number of horseshoe crabs that we're taking. The horseshoe crab population tanked around 1998, 2000, and that was when the red knot population started to plummet. We've had 15 years of, I guess I would say, lethargic regulation because the horseshoe crab population has yet to rebound. And yet, if you look in South Carolina, where the bait industry has been banned, and where there's a huge biomedical take of horseshoe crabs, the population is stable. So I think it's really important that we both try to understand how more horseshoe crabs can do better when they're taken for biomedical use. But I think it's also equally and probably more important that we reduce the bait fishery.
How big an issue is the fact that there is a pretty significant size difference between male and female horseshoe crabs? Does that make one more desirable as bait than another?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. And of course, the females are definitely more desirable as bait. And they may even be more desirable in the biomedical industry because they have more blood. And you can tell where along the eastern seaboard female horseshoe crabs are preferentially taken. I really believe that it's important to spend a lot of time, even though it took me a lot of time to do this, looking at old histories, because old histories tell us what used to be and therefore what could be. And if we only look at what the present is, sometimes we get a very skewed idea of what's possible. And what I'm trying to say here is that in the past and in areas where there is no horseshoe crab bait fishery and there is no biomedical fishery, when you watch horseshoe crabs come spawning up on the beach, you see them coming in pairs. Where females have been taken preferentially over males, you see ratios of 3-to-1, males to females, 5-to-1, 8-to-1, 12-to-1, sometimes 30-to-1. So in answer to your question, yes, the female horseshoe crab is quite desirable.
You found a report that said in the 19th century there were literally wagon loads of horseshoe crab eggs in Delaware Bay after that spawning period.
Yes, and that's another reason why it's important to look at the history. That was so shocking to me because one year when I went to Delaware Bay, I could hardly even see any eggs on the beach. I would step back into the boat and I'd find a few of them in my sandals. And then at another beach, I did see them piling up a little bit, but it was because they'd been caught in some of the rocks. And it was only a couple of teaspoonfuls. There's a huge difference between a few teaspoonfuls and a wagon load. But a wagon load is what we could be shooting for.
Tell us a little bit about the red knots we can find along the Texas coast.
Well, that was one of the most exciting pieces for me of this research, because when you read about the red knot, as I was getting the background information to start figuring out where I was going to travel, Texas wasn't really a big part of the story. Historically, people thought maybe 100, 200, maybe 300 birds might winter there, but they didn't know very much about it. And I was at a meeting with red knot researchers from the entire flyway, South America, all the way up through Canada. And there was a biologist there who said that he was seeing some red knots in Texas, but they didn't have flags on them. And since about 25% of the population along the Atlantic Flyway has been flagged, if you don't see any birds with flags, it means there's something else going on. And one of the other scientists there kiddingly said to him, well, if you're not seeing any birds with flags, it must be because you need some new lens wipes for your spotting scope, and I'll give you a few. And I thought, well, this is kind of interesting. I'm going to go down to Texas and talk to this researcher, whose name is David Newstead. And I spent a few days with him, and it was one of the most, I mean, every place I went was a stunningly beautiful place. But I will always have a special place in my heart for the Laguna Madre. That is just a gorgeous, gorgeous part of Texas. And 2 million birds fly through there, migrating through, wintering, or nesting. And David had been speaking to two older men who had spent years either on Mustang Island or on Padre Island, one of them for 35 years walking the beach every day, another for 20 years. And they said they'd seen large numbers of knots there late in the fall. So he radio tagged them, and I can tell you what it was like to
this is the
go
perfect,
up in the airplane.
Perfect setup for the break, and we'll come back to this in just a minute. We're speaking this hour with author Deborah Kramer. Her new book is called The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and an Epic Journey. You can join us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest, Deborah Kramer, is a visiting scholar at MIT and author of a new book called The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and an Epic Journey. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Deborah, before the break, you set us up. You went in South Texas near Mustang and Padre Islands with David Newstead looking for red knots. And what did you find?
Well, David was very curious to know where these birds went after autumn had passed and they were no longer on the beach. And so he put some radio tags on 11 birds. He glued it on with some kind of an epoxy, which disintegrates pretty rapidly, so he didn't have a whole lot of time to be able to find these birds over a 600-square-mile area. One day, he took me with him. We drove out to an airport outside of Corpus Christi, got into a very small, I think it was 24-foot, single-engine plane that was painted to look like a huge flag of the state of Texas. And the pilot, Ans Windham, took off, flew down the Padre Island National Seashore, and then turned right into the laguna. And they had a radio receiver in the plane, and the idea was, in this huge expanse, to listen for signals from these 10 or 11 birds. It required an amazing amount of acrobatics on the part of the pilot. The receiver, when it's picking up the signals, sounds a little bit like a chirping cricket. So he would hear the chirp chirp. David, these two had obviously been working together for a really long time. Wouldn't even talk to him. He'd just signal with his finger, and then the plane would swoop down. And if we got closer, that was really great. But if we didn't, we'd level off, ascend, and then swoop down again. And we did this for probably 5 or 6 hours, each time following the signal of the birds closer and closer to the border at the Rio Grande River. So then we had what was to me a very interesting situation of needing to call in to Homeland Security to say where we were and promise that we would not be crossing the border, even though the birds clearly were. At the same time, carrying out all of these acrobatics. And I think he did find a couple of birds that day in one of the national wildlife refuges at the southern end of the Padre Island National Seashore. But it wasn't really definitive, and we had to turn back because we'd run out of gas. But then he did find quite a few later on. And the other thing that he did was he put data loggers on the birds, which measure the time of sunrise and sunset. And you can follow those birds all along their migration. And then if you catch them and take off the data logger, you can discover a lot about where the birds have been. And what he discovered was that these two older men who had told him the birds were wintering in the laguna, he basically confirmed that. And it's not a couple of hundred birds. It may be 1,000. He found that birds that nest in the Arctic, the babies, some of the babies don't go all the way back to Cerro del Fuego. Some of them actually spend their first summer in the laguna. And that the birds who are living in the laguna basically spend 80% of the year there. And they're taking a completely different route going up to the Arctic. They're not going along the eastern seaboard, which is why they didn't have any flags on them. But they're following what I called in the Narrow Edge a ghost trail, a really old migration highway going up through the prairie potholes of the Great Plains and into the prairie potholes of Canada. And again, if you look at the old histories, these birds and many other shorebirds used to go in great numbers along this route. So he's discovered, just in time for the endangered species listing, that this route is actually still in use, and possibly it will be able to do some rehabilitation work along it so that more birds will be able to travel there in the future.
So red knots were just listed recently by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as endangered. What kind of action does that trigger in their defense?
Well, they were actually listed as threatened on the threatened and endangered species list. I'm hoping what that's going to mean is that there will be more resources going to protecting their homes along the entire route. That is going to mean different things in different places. In Delaware Bay, it's meaning already repairs of some of these beaches that have eroded away over the years. I'm hoping it's going to mean a little tighter regulation of the horseshoe crab take. I'm hoping it's going to mean a little more ability to get up into the Arctic and find out exactly what's happening up there as the weather changes. I'm hoping it's going to mean a much larger public education to help people understand that. And this is something that, you know, I have to admit, I didn't really even know. I used to think it was a wonderful thing when I would walk along a beach and I would get close to a flock of sandpipers and they would arc up over the waves. It really is a beautiful thing to watch that. But when you know that disturbing the birds like that means that they have less time to eat. Maybe now I try to detour around them so I'm not disturbing them.
That's a good. That is a good lesson for people who like to walk on the beaches and assume that you're not doing anything harmful.
Yeah, well, people always thought the birds could fly away, but they're running out of room to fly away.
By the way, we want to let people know that the KERA Think Tumblr has some pictures of horseshoe crabs and their blood being bled in a lab. And it's both sweet and sort of sad to see them kind of strapped into these rubber contraptions and held there. And they're it's almost like they're on an assembly line. But if you're curious about it, it's at the KERA Think Tumblr page. What is it like, Deborah, to try to track red knot populations in a place like Hudson Bay?
Well, these places are very, very remote. So when I and I went to two places up there. I went to Southern Hudson Bay and James Bay, where the birds stage when they start coming back. And I went to Southampton Island in Northern Hudson Bay, right beneath the Arctic Circle. And that trip, probably more than anything else, reinforced for me how wonderfully capable these birds are. I had to, in order to get ready to go on this trip, I had to make sure I could walk vast distances every day. I tried to prepare for this by swimming as hard as I could, an hour and a half, two or three times a week, by going around the block where I live, which is a 4-mile circuit. That didn't quite prepare me for walking 10 or 12 miles every day through the ice and the snow. I had every single piece of cold weather clothing that I owned, and the birds were up there with just their fat and their feathers. And there was a bird that was in Delaware Bay while I was in Delaware Bay, and the bird was still in Delaware Bay when I went home to get ready to go to the Arctic. I had to fly to Ottawa because the Canadian Wildlife Service and the National Environmental Research Center in Canada were taking me, and they wanted me to be sure that I knew how to fire accurately a 12-gauge shotgun, which I did not know how to do. So I had to spend a day in Ottawa doing that. And then we went up to Baffin Island to wait for the bush pilots to take us to East Bay, Southampton Island. There was a hurricane raging over Southampton Island that grounded us for 4 days in Iqaluit. The bush pilots are landing on pieces of tundra that have no lighting, no radar. It's just a very short gravel strip, so that if you can't tell the difference between the snow falling and the clouds, it's not a really good idea to fly. So we stayed in Iqaluit waiting for the weather to clear. When it finally did, we flew in and we went for a walk. And one of the researchers told me that she had found 12 knots, including one that had a flag. And I immediately went over to see what its number was, and I called in, and that bird had been in Delaware Bay when I was in Delaware Bay and beat me up there.
Wow.
Without any of the luggage, any of the clothing. It was awesome.
It didn't have to be able to fire a 12-gauge in case of polar bears.
No, it didn't.
That was
And it was eating off the land. And we went into the North Mart in Iqaluit. The research team was going to be up there for 8 weeks. I was only going to be up there for three. It turned out to be 3.5 because the weather was really bad going out. But the bill for all of the food we had to bring in there was enormous. They weren't coming with anything. And I could not have lived eating tiny little insects for 3.5 weeks.
I should say the polar bear thing, nobody wanted to have to do that, but it's become polar bears have become, I guess they're more in the area where the researchers are now because the climate is changing.
Yes, and it's an ironic thing because the polar bear is on the endangered species list also. So nobody wants to kill a polar bear in order to study another species on the threatened and endangered species list. So this team actually went through a lot of rigorous training, and there was an Inuit man who lives on Southampton Island who stayed with us, who has an astonishing skill at reading the landscape. I would look out there, and even after I'd been there for 3 weeks, and see white. He would look out there, and he would see white that looked a little bit yellow. That would be a polar bear. He would see white that looked a little whiter. That would be an Arctic fox. So he could spot these bears from tremendous distance. And at the Eider camp nearby, there were people on the roof of the camp frequently monitoring all the bears. So the whole idea was to keep them away from where we were and to make sure they were chased away so that we never had to be in a position of shooting them. Now, at the Eider camp, because the ice is melting so much earlier in the season, the bears are coming ashore and eating the eider eggs. And so now, as soon as the ice melts, video cameras are put in so the scientists can study this long distance, and the team is evacuated because it really isn't safe anymore.
Hmm. Deborah, for people who hear this story and think, well, that's all well and good, but I may never see these creatures. I don't interact with them. Can you explain why they mean more than even simply the loss of a single species?
You know, Chris, I've thought about that a lot, and I devoted an entire chapter in this book toward looking at the question, does losing one more bird matter? It's for other species of birds besides shorebirds, there have been pretty significant implications for us when a bird becomes extinct. For example, and this is particularly true in New England, for example, we lost the passenger pigeon. And when we did, we lost a big control on the acorn and beechnut growth because they used to eat a ton of acorns and beechnuts. And what was left enabled burgeoning populations of mice who are transmitters of diseases carried by ticks. And now, for example, everybody in my neighborhood has had one or maybe two kinds of tick-borne diseases. Hmm. So birds can really help us in ways we can't anticipate. But it's more than money. I don't think we can put a financial value on that which nurtures the human spirit.
The new book by author Deborah Kramer is called The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and an Epic Journey. Deborah, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Chris, thank you for including me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect produced today's show. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.